So how do healthcare professionals, including EMTs and paramedics, handle the families of patients who are dead or dying? Well, we have a special segment on that topic from EMS World Expo's Physio Control Podcast Studio. So if that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of The Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is The Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome all of you to this week's show. In this week's episode of The Medic Cast, I actually have a special segment recorded last week at the EMS World Expo 2015 conference in Las Vegas, where I invited paramedic and fire captain Tom Boothelet, as well as paramedic educator Amy Eisenhower, on the show in the podcast studio to talk about death and dying in the EMS environment. Now, this is all based on an article I looked at on the show recently this past summer, looking at how a doctor expressed difficulty being honest with cancer patients about their true terminal outlook. If doctors are having trouble with this, what does that say for the paramedics and EMTs out there having to notify families and patients of bad news all the time? Well, we'll find out soon enough coming up in this episode. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure that you are checking out the additional links and information available for you over at the MedicCast blog. You can find that over at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Just click that link, and it'll take you right to the most recent episode, and you can also scroll down there and find previous episodes as well. There's also a search box there for you on the right-hand side of the page. If you're looking for something in particular, just put a keyword in there. But take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show each week and understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, you can do so by reaching out to me by email at podmedic@mac.com. Shoot me an email with your comments, your questions on an episode, or anything, really. You can also send me suggestions, interview ideas for future episodes, or whatever. But I do get back to you. I respond to every email that comes in, and I'll come and get a hold of you as well by email if you send me one first. Also, don't forget to get the MedicCast free mobile app. You should have it on your device so that you can get the shows delivered to you each week. That's enough contact information. We'll get on into the rest of this week's show, coming right up with a special segment from EMS World Expo 2015 in the Physio Control Podcast Studio. Jamie Davis here from the Medic Cast, and we're here with another episode here from EMS World Expo 2015 in the Physio Control Podcast Studio. I'm excited to be talking with our two guests here about a very serious topic, something that we need to be dealing with more based on an article, but I'll get into that in a second. Before I get to that, I do want to introduce our guests. I have Amy Eisenhower.
Hi.
How are you doing, Amy? Introduce yourself. Tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Amy Eisenhower. I'm a provider in New Jersey. For the last 20 years in both volunteer and professional circles. I have a blog called The EMS Siren.
That's good.
Yeah.
And I have Tom Boothelet here, who may or may not need any introduction, but Tom, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and what you're involved with lately.
I'm a fire captain paramedic with Hilton Head Island Fire Rescue, where I'm the cardiac care program manager and also the STEMI and care site coordinator. So. I coordinate all of our protocols for acute STEMI and cardiac arrest and things of that nature.
Excellent. So I think, Amy, it was you who sent me this link or maybe responded
possibly,
back to me
yes.
Posting it. And it was an article in The Atlantic that said, whose job is it to talk to patients about death? And the article is a doctor actually talking about how he felt awkward
talking to patients about death and how he avoided the subject because the patients were hoping for a positive outcome, so he just kept giving them hope, even though he knew in this cancer patient, in the article that he talks about, was imminently approaching death and that no amount of intervention was going to really make any difference. And you pointed out that this is something that EMS providers have to deal with every day when we have to call codes, when we have to pronounce patients at the scene, when we have to deal with DNRs or family members that don't want us to honor the DNRs or the lack of DNRs in a situation where a patient's clearly in hospice care. So I think I'll start with you, Amy, because you kind of spurred the idea for this topic. What do you think is the biggest issue for EMS providers when it comes to dealing with end of life and talking to families and patients about end of life?
I think a lot of it is lack of education on the topic. So when you go through your initial EMT training, you're taught in your state, whatever your regulations are, this is the DNR form that we'll honor. These are the things that we can recognize. And if that's not there, then you have to do everything you can. And the other side of that is sometimes families get upset because obviously their family member is now dying and maybe they were not prepared for what that really looked like. So they call 911 and we get there. And if you're not familiar with hospice care or those facilities, you don't know what to do. And that's not part of our education curriculum.
Tom, you had this, and I've actually had a death in the family recently too from someone who was in hospice care. You know, and I have similar fears, but you really felt this topic strike home for you.
My mother is still living, but she's down to 77 pounds. She suffers advanced dementia, and it's been a long road. So my father and I care for her 24 hours a day. And I think it was about a month ago, Maplewood Fire Department outside of Minneapolis, there was a situation where they had responded to a nursing home where a female patient, I believe she had advanced Parkinson's for 25 years, had lost the use of her legs, no longer had decisional capacity. And while she was sleeping, she had vomited. And I think maybe the son was there. Someone called for the nurses to say, hey, you know, she's choking or something like that. During that process, the nurses felt that she had possibly lost pulses or had weak pulses. They contacted 911, they initiated CPR. So when EMS arrived at the scene, they started resuscitating her, decided that they had achieved return of spontaneous circulation, and then the spouse, who it turns out had durable power of healthcare attorney, said, no, stop, she wouldn't have wanted this. She wouldn't have wanted this, please stop. And so they honored the spouse's wishes and put the patient back into her room, and 20 minutes later she died. Subsequently, a complaint was filed. The city of Maplewood won't say who filed the complaint. I strongly suspect it was the nursing home, but there was a investigation by the police chief, Paul Schnell, and he later said in an interview he felt that he was obliged to see if there's any criminal wrongdoing, which is, to me, outrageous. Finally spoke to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and someone with a brain there said, yeah, these were just paramedics acting in good faith, trying to abide by the family's wishes in a difficult situation. But to me, it represented a deeper failure in the EMS profession, because we've been kicking this can down the road for a long time. We've allowed administrative laws into almost every state that say, if you don't have the right piece of paper with the right signature and stamp, you have to do things that are flagrantly unethical if you really look at it. Look at a woman that has no hope of meaningful recovery. What more ideal situation could there be than a resuscitation where all the stakeholders in the patient's care are present, the decision makers have consensus about what should be done, and there's no meaningful hope for recovery? If only every time we terminated resuscitative efforts, those criteria were met, I think that would be a really good thing. So it's unfortunate to me that our national associations haven't stepped up and said, you know, there's even a model for it in Seattle. King County Medic One wrote a protocol, I believe it's called Futility or something like that, but you can download it with the toolkit from the Resuscitation Academy. And if certain criteria are met, even with no DNR at the scene, you can determine that it is a futile or inappropriate resuscitation attempt. So you would expect that. They're the best in the world, or at least in the nation, at resuscitation. These types of things are very demoralizing to crews. In fact, I remember about 2 years ago, we went to a memory care facility for a female patient that was reportedly in cardiac arrest. In my department, we send an ambulance, two engines, and a battalion chief to a cardiac arrest. Got there, the patient was a bilateral amputee, was wearing an adult incontinence brief, and had some kind of peg tube. And I took one look at it and said, what are we doing here, you know? And the paramedic that was working the code said, yeah, they said it's a full code. I said, no, that must be some mistake. So I called for the person. I don't know if it was a nurse. It probably wasn't a nurse, but anyway, they came and said, no, yeah, it's a full code. So we all felt very icky about it, but we continued, saw VF on the monitor, shocked the patient. There was a sudden rise in end-tidal CO2. We had a pulse, we had a blood pressure. So I said to the guy, the code commander, I said, I hate to break it to you, buddy, but this patient meets all of our criteria for code ICE. And he said, are you kidding me? I said, we're in or we're out. You know, yeah, right now we're right in. We have a protocol. We got to follow it.
If you're gonna do the resuscitation with the full.
I don't do show codes. Right. I don't believe in show codes. I think they're a horrible, horrible thing. So, anyway, we got to the hospital, and it turned out that patient not only was a DNR, was actually a hospice patient. Now, I didn't call the police and ask them to perform a criminal investigation on the nurses that were involved in the patient's care at this memory care facility. I wouldn't have done that, but so to have that reversed when an unusual occurrence happens the other direction, I find very offensive. I don't think that that should have happened if in fact it was the nursing home that complained, but I really think we have to have more dialogue with all of the stakeholders involved in the patient's care, and we should not be beholden to a piece of paper if ethically doing the right thing is obviously something different. And if we want to really emerge as a real profession, our answer to everything can't always be contact medical control. I would have, as a risk management procedure, I would have contacted online medical control because it was such a set of unusual circumstances. And in fact, when I terminate a resuscitation in a nursing home, we usually do 20 minutes of ALS. If there's no response to it, I find the nurse at the nurse's station and say, we've been doing this resuscitation for 20 minutes. The patient's in asystole. Right now, we think that scientifically speaking, there would be very little medical reason to transport this patient to the hospital. I believe that this is a futile resuscitation, and our plan is to call online medical control to terminate the resuscitation. What do you think about that? And they have said in the past, that sounds reasonable to me. And then when I call med control, I say, yeah, if the family's present, I discuss it with them. I try and get consensus with everybody and hope that there's no outliers. I wouldn't intentionally do something that upset a family member, a nurse that's going to file a complaint. The first thing we should do is what we think is right for the patient care experience, but I think to minimize complaints and to really perform the way we need to, get consensus with as many people as possible to conclude a very serious manner in a professional way if possible. But I think we just need more help from our professional associations on this topic.
And it's about communication.
Yes.
I mean, most of what you just said is about effectively communication with your team, communication with the other medical personnel on the scene, and in this case of a nursing home, we're a hospice situation, and effective communication with the family members to let them know this is what we have going on in very frank and honest terms of what you see and what you understand the situation to be. And you're right. Most of the time, people are going to make that decision to say, yes, you're absolutely right. Go along with that. Has that been your experience?
Yes. I think that it's important to have conversation, but it's also important to have some sort of previous experience. And obviously, you don't just get that. You come out of school with whatever you learned, the general curriculum, and now you're expected to communicate with somebody's family member or somebody who's highly upset. And I think that would occur in any case, whether the person was terminally ill or whether it was a sudden death. The family's still going to be upset. That's their loved one. So how do you speak to somebody like that? So part of the communication is, how would you approach somebody? Mm-hmm. How do you speak to somebody about that? You know, how do you talk to somebody about medical things that maybe, like this article in The Atlantic said, maybe the doctor didn't tell them it was this serious. And I've been reading many articles and books about this where doctors felt uncomfortable when a patient expected a quick fix or some sort of treatment algorithm where you do X, Y, and Z, and then I'm fine. And unfortunately, that's not always what happens. So then we get whatever rolled downhill to us. You show up to somebody's house, they don't know you, they don't have any experience with you. And I think that's very scary for newer providers or inexperienced providers that never had to talk to family about that.
And I'll tell you my experience, the first time I had to notify a family of the fact that we weren't going to resuscitate someone who had rigor and had lividity, and so we clearly they'd been down for a while, but they had started CPR as a family, and when we got there and assessed the patient, realized that there was no reason to do that. I had a senior medic on the scene with me when I was very new, who said, "All right, we're going to go talk to the family. You come with me, and watch what I do." And that was how I learned how to very honestly, very frankly, but with caring, approach a family and say, you know, we went and we've assessed your family member. We've looked at our toolkit of what we can and can't do, and unfortunately your family member has passed and has died, and we are unable to resuscitate them at this time. And yes, the family was upset, but I also think that they would not have wanted us to go in there and do the show code and just to make it look like we were doing something and have some false hope for the half hour we were there, and then roll them to the hospital and then let the doctor tell them, which is what some people in our area used to do.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is not going to be something that's easily solved. It's nice to hear that Seattle's doing something that's moving this forward. It's nice to hear from you to say this is a topic we need to cover and need to talk more about. Any final thoughts, short, brief thoughts from either of you about this? Amy, do you have anything you'd like to add? Where you'd like to see this moving forward for your area or your jurisdiction?
Oh, I would love people to have a conversation. So for providers to have a conversation and feel comfortable to say, wow, I didn't know, one, that you know, there was palliative care or hospice at home. Two, I never thought about having to notify somebody. Or yes, I was afraid when that happened. How do I do that? And for people to feel comfortable to admit, yes, I would like to learn that, because this is part of our jobs, even though we're taught to quote unquote race the reaper and we're gonna save lives. And unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't happen as we've discussed. So I would love to have providers have a conversation, and like both of you mentioned, for the larger EMS community as a whole to say, this is a problem. It is something that we actively deal with regularly. What are we gonna do?
Tom?
After the situation in Minneapolis, I was a little confused by the situation, why the nursing home didn't seem to know the patient's code status, and so I did a little bit of research, and it turns out that Medicare requires that when patients are admitted to a nursing home, that they be provided information about advanced directives, but it does, and it requires that they have a page in the chart for that information if it exists, but it does not require that they have a binary yes, no, basically. And so I think what happens a lot of times is if they don't have it, it's a full code. And so that's almost like, well, we don't know, so it's a full code, or we never got an answer back. So our default setting is, no matter how inappropriate, we resuscitate to the point where it's been written into the law. I would like to think that we're entering a little bit more enlightened time in EMS. This has caused some very serious problems already. And so A very simple fix could be if you're admitting into the nursing home, if the person has no decisional capacity and someone else is the durable power of healthcare attorney, I would make it, you know, full code DNR other, I would make the decision maker sign the box so that there's no question as to what that patient's code status is, that someone's not only received the information but has made some decision, however tentative, about what the patient's code status is. That's one thing. And then the other point that I would offer is, when we visited Wake County EMS, one of the interesting things that Brent, and he's a very interesting guy anyway, but one of the interesting things that Brent Meyer had said is that their paramedics were all certified grief counselors.
Wow.
And so if you really think about it, in my fire department, everybody could tell you that a 1.5-inch stack tip on a master stream flows 600 gallons a minute, but they couldn't tell you what to say or not to say to a grieving spouse. And so if we really believe that we're here to serve Mrs. Smith the best that we can, and we do a needs analysis and realize this is something where we don't really have the tool set that we need to handle a lot of these ethical issues, then, you know, maybe we need to prioritize some of this training that maybe is not glamorous, but really actually might help someone in a very profound way that we could be very proud of after the call. Because any more this late in my career, I could retire as soon as 2 years or as late as 7 years, depending on whether or not I buy non-qualified time. And the calls that mean the most to me right now are where I feel like I've really helped someone, not necessarily saved someone, but that I've really helped someone.
I hear you. Tom, where can folks find you? Online or on the web?
They could find me on Twitter at tbouthelet or ems12lead.com or ecgmedicaltraining.com. You know, I'm around.
You're around.
Yeah.
You've got your hands in a lot of pies out there on some Facebook groups that are doing some pretty exciting things.
That's true. The resuscitation group on Facebook. Thanks for that. Yeah.
Definitely. Amy, how about you? Where can folks find you?
You can find my blog at theemssiren.com. I'm also on Twitter, theemssiren. And I'm on Facebook under Amy Eisenhower.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on. This is a difficult topic. I think this is something we need to continue to talk about in future conferences. Maybe we'll come back the next time and we'll have some more positive things to say about some change. So we'll look forward to that.
Hope so.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and you can always find me under the handle PodMedic everywhere else, and of course, MedicCast.com. This is Jamie from the Physio Control Podcast Studio here at EMS World Expo 2015, and we look forward to having you check out all of our segments that'll be posted over at ProMedNetwork.com.